Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week touts US record stats and Brexit. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Andy Malt.
We've had a bit of a break from our normal editions of these while you've been on your international jet-setting career.
It's a while since we've had a standard edition, but due to some very efficient recording of special editions, I think people should be getting on the socials and congratulating us on being organised enough to have three special editions in the can.
Yes, some very efficient recording and the discovery of the lost episode that we did about, I don't know, 7 months ago now.
We did record the Sue the Fan special quite some time ago and forgot to put it out. But it was good because it turned out that I had quite a few weeks when I was not available due to talking about stuff, but talking about stuff not in a studio in London, but in a lecture room somewhere else in the world.
Yes, and we're still on tour this week.
We are.
We're not in our normal studio.
We are not.
Just in case the sound's, you know, obviously not as good, we are in a flat in Greenwich. We are not in a studio in Shoreditch.
But Andy Malt has done a very good job of building a studio around this dining room table. What this means is, and this is quite exciting, this edition of Setlist is not only being co-hosted by Andy Malt, it's being produced by Andy Malt.
Yeah.
Now, you might be thinking that's a bad idea.
Yeah, don't give me that credit up front. I think it's going to sound all right.
And depending on how it's sounding, you might be correct to think that's a bad idea. But you are actually qualified to produce our podcast.
I don't know if I go that far.
Well, you've got more qualifications for producing the podcast than you have for delivering the podcast.
Fair point, yeah.
With your, what is it, AS level.
Yeah, I've got an AS level in music technology. I mean, that's, I suppose there's audio recording in that.
So the conclusion of that is,
you're going to get a half A-level standard audio production based on late 90s audio production standards.
So given we've been away from doing proper podcasts for a week, that is what we are bringing to you, our listeners, on this edition of Setlist. So it's going to be good.
Yes. Anyway, the point is, we, as ever, except when we don't, are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last 7 days.
Maybe a little bit more than 7 days.
Yeah, 7 days. Also, because, well, nothing happened in the last 7 days, really. So we have had to bulk it out a bit. Luckily, we were off for 3 weeks.
So we had plenty of material to rely on.
Yes, but I guess before we get to that, we should probably talk about one thing that happened in the last week, which I think you think is interesting.
Yeah, this definitely did happen in the last week and is definitely interesting. So you may have noticed, if you are an avid CMU daily reader, you will know that we have published a whole load more information about our conferences that are happening as part of the Great Escape in May. So we are presenting free conferences this year for the Great Escape delegates on the Wednesday of Great Escape Week. That's the 13th of May. We will have our music education conference on the Thursday, the 14th of May. We will have our music media conference, and for fans of maths, you'll already know this, on the Friday, the 15th of May, we have our global markets conference. And so what we've basically done now is we've published schedules, outlines for all the topics that are going to be talked about over each of those conferences. So on the education day, we're going to be looking at things like why we think that creative entrepreneurship and fan-based building should become part of the music curriculum and what we even mean by that. So that's one of the topics we're going to be talking about at the education conference. Hey, on the Thursday, we're going to have a whole section looking at the podcasting business and how podcasters can go about building an audience. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to learning from the experts about how podcasters can build an audience.
Yeah, me too.
Although, we do have an audience. It's the second bit of this section I'm most interested in, how podcasters make money. Because that bit, we definitely haven't cracked here at Setlist.
So don't tell them that.
So we will learn as part of it. And also, we're talking about how podcasts now have an increasingly important role in promoting music. So our whole podcast focus as part of our music media conference on the Thursday. We'll also be looking at all things sync and as part of that evolution in the way TV licensing is done. And by that, I don't mean the government trying to get rid of the BBC TV license, although we might talk about that at some point in the Music Media Conference.
Someone's got to talk about it.
Even though one minister has denied that Boris Johnson wants to get rid of the TV license, although we all know he does. So maybe we'll talk about that kind of TV licensing as part of the Music Media Conference. But what we're going to be really interested in is all the debates around how TV production companies and broadcasters license music. Is the TV blanket license in the UK and elsewhere falling apart? Will it not exist in the future? What about the big bad broadcasters who are trying to get the performing rights off the songwriters as well as the mechanical rights? All of that will be discussed as part of the Music Media Conference. And then on the Friday with Global Markets, we're going to do the fastest tour of the world you've ever seen, checking in on all of the different regions of the world. Basically, I'm just going to be there for the whole day talking about my various travels over the last few months. I'll tell you about where I've been. Russia. I can do Russia. I know everything about the Russian music industry now. Being out there. Where else have I been recently? I can tell you about the Danish industry.
When you can't even remember where you've been, that's when it's just too much.
I've been in Germany.
Too many holidays.
The German music industry. I'm going out to India next month. So it'll just be me, basically, with a map and my passport.
Boasting.
Talking about all of my travels. Although, I have not been to Latin America of late, and I don't think I'll be going there between now and May, although if anyone out there would like to fix that. So we'll have to get somebody else to talk about Latin America, I think, and maybe Africa as well. And who knows, even North America probably will get a mention in there too. So all of this is now on both the Great Escape and the CMU Insights website. We've also announced a whole load of great speakers. So the first chunk of information is out there. And then we've got so much more to announce about the Great Escape, both the CMU strands, other things happening as part of the TG conference this year. Look out for lots more announcements coming in the coming weeks through the CMU Daily and both the CMU and TGE social channels. Get your delegate passes or conference tickets now, is what I have to say.
But thank goodness that is not what we're here to talk about this week.
Well, not all we're here to talk about this week.
All right, when we have talked about
we've it. We've talked so about
it. That is clearly a not untruth.
And but I think our listeners would expect us to talk about it.
All right.
But we've done it now.
Look, I've given you the right to reply. What more do you want? Actually, this week, we're going to be discussing the continued rise in record industry income in the US and how the UK government's post-Brexit immigration policy could affect the music industry. But first, two British ticket touts found guilty of fraud last month have been sentenced for a total of 6.5 years in prison, a ruling that has been dubbed an important milestone by the government agency that pursued the criminal case against them.
So yes, this is the ongoing battle against secondary ticketing here in the UK, although if you're thinking, hang on a second, jail sentences, things have ramped up since the last time we were properly talking about the battle against online ticket touting. Well, this is one of the criminal actions that was pursued by an entity called National Trading Standards. So we have mentioned these before, I think, on Setlist, but most of our discussion about the battle against secondary ticketing and ensuring that the ticket resale market, the touts and the platforms they use are complying with consumer rights law, we've talked a lot more about the work that the Competition and Markets Authority has done trying to bring Viagogo and StubHub and previously the Ticketmaster resale sites into line. And obviously the CMA made its demands of all the resale platforms and then started enforcing those demands to the extent that Ticketmaster just shut its sites down so it didn't have to meet those demands. And then StubHub did tick the boxes, didn't they? And then Viagogo didn't. And then there was the court action. And then Viagogo kind of complied. And then it turned out that it was StubHub who were no longer complying. So we've talked a lot about all of that here on Setlist. But concurrent to the CMA's investigation into Viagogo, StubHub, etc., this other government agency called National Trading Standards, it took responsibility for investigating the conduct of the actual touts, of a small group of industrial-level touts who were selling tickets on the platforms like Viagogo and StubHub, but at an incredibly prolific level. And so it and its officers investigated whether or not these touts were breaking any laws. And among the people being prosecuted were these two guys who went to court last year. Yes, and I suppose the development since we last did an edition of Setlist is that they were found guilty and then they were sentenced.
Yeah, so the two touts in this case were Peter Hunter and David Smith, who ran a prolific ticket touting operation via companies known as TicketWiz and BZZ. When they got to court last year at Leeds Crown Court, the prosecutors dubbed them dishonest fraudsters motivated by greed. That they'd run a touting operation was not in question. It was whether or not they'd actually broken any laws in doing so.
Yes, nobody, not even Hunter and Smith themselves, were denying that these companies existed, that they'd got lots of tickets from the primary sites, that they'd resold those tickets for profit through various different secondary ticketing platforms. All of that was agreed. But yeah, the key question was, well, is anything that these guys have done actually against the law? Are they guilty of any crimes? And in some ways, this was a test case on this. There was another case involving touts that got to court earlier than this one, although that then sort of fell apart for tedious admin reasons. So this was really the first of these criminal cases to test whether or not the conduct of these guys, the way these guys gathered tickets, sold them, the operation of their ticket touting businesses, whether that actually broke any laws. But when the jury at Leeds Crown Court last month sat down in their little room and weighed up all the things that the prosecutors had said to them during the case in court, they concluded that yes, these guys had broken the law. They were guilty of a crime. The two crimes they were specifically found guilty of were fraudulent trading and possessing an article for fraud. So those were the convictions that were passed by the court last month. And then last week, National Trading Standards itself put out a statement where they basically provided a list of the specific things that these two guys have been doing that led to the fraud conviction once they got to court.
So that included using specialist bots to hoover up tickets from primary sites, knowingly breaching the terms and conditions of primary sites, going out of their way to circumvent tactics employed by primary sites to combat touting, knowingly selling tickets that risked being cancelled by the promoter without alerting the buyer to this fact, and speculatively listing for sale tickets that they had not yet secured.
So a familiar list to anybody who's been following the whole campaign against ticket touting. Obviously, most of those things are things that anti-touting campaigners have been complaining about for quite some time now, but interesting, as I say, in terms of the potential precedent being set in this case, that list of activities are enough to say that these guys have broken the law. They are guilty of a criminal offence. The other thing National Trading Standards talked about was how when you're running a ticket touting operation like this, because the primary ticketing sites obviously for in-demand shows, there's a cap, isn't there, on how many tickets any one person can buy. And the way that's kind of regulated is partly with email address, but more importantly with a credit card. So they'll only sell 6 tickets on any one credit card, which means that if you're a ticket touting operation and you want to buy 100 tickets, you need to have a lot of credit cards because you need to have a different card for each set of 6 or whatever tickets that you are buying. And so what these guys had done is they had got family and friends to register credit cards and debit cards, which they then used in order to buy the tickets. And so the other thing that National Trading Standards and the prosecutors were saying was that A, that meant that they were misrepresenting themselves and lying when they were contacting the primary ticket agents with queries, because actually they were pretending to be the cardholder when they were not. Also, by getting these other people to register credit and debit cards for them to use, they were potentially making those other people liable for fraud as well as themselves. So that was another thing on the big long list of things that National Trading Standards said were the reasons why these two guys had broken the law and were guilty of fraudulent conduct.
In wrapping up the case, the judge stated that Hunter and Smith had run their operation for a little over 7 years, making a net profit of £3.5 million in just the last 2 of those years. So it wasn't a little thing selling a ticket here and there. It was a fairly sizable operation.
They were doing quite well with their touting.
As a result, based on their roles within the touting venture, Hunter was sentenced to 4 years in prison, while Smith will spend 30 months behind bars.
So as I say, quite a big step forward in that, although we've had action against the sites previously, the CMA putting pressure on those sites to change the way that they list tickets, the way they sell tickets, to be more transparent, to be more customer friendly, and obviously particularly with Viagogo, they went to court to force the company in line. And then when they initially didn't fall in line, there was then the question of, well, they're now in contempt of court. Does that mean that action could be taken against individual directors of the business? But all of that, although significant, I suppose, the idea that these two guys are actually going to jail for the touting operation that they've run, that seems like a big step forward. And obviously, for everybody on the side who would like to see the end of industrial level touting for profit online, the hope is that this decision and this sentencing will deter other people who are either already running touting businesses of a similar kind or are considering setting up a touting business, it will deter those people from doing so because, well, however many millions you might make for that operation, I'm not sure it's worth serving several years in jail for the conviction of fraud that may come with it.
So needless to say, the chair of National Trading Standards, Toby Harris, was quite pleased with the outcome of this case. He said, "This is an important milestone in the fight to tackle online ticket touts who fraudulently buy and resell tickets to thousands of victims to line their own pockets. Today's sentences send a strong message to similar online ticket touts. These are criminal offences that can lead to prison sentences. I hope this leads to a step change in the secondary ticketing market, making it easier and safer for consumers buying tickets in future."
As for the people who've been leading the campaign against secondary ticketing or seeking more regulation of secondary ticketing, so organisations like the Music Industry-led Fanfare Alliance and also MPs like Sharon Hodgson, who have been obviously very vocal on all of this for a while now, they welcomed the ruling, although they all said there is still more work to be done. One of the things that's been talked about is how National Trading Standards need more budget to go after more touts to try and enforce this law. Because obviously one of the problems we've had throughout with secondary ticketing is even if we agree that whether it's the platforms or the touts or whoever are breaching consumer rights laws, that only really means anything if somebody enforces those laws. And so obviously, hence why National Trading Standards was given responsibility to go after these touts. But there is the argument that National Trading Standards need more money to pursue more of these cases. As for Fanfare, they also welcomed the ruling and also said that they felt that this ruling in the criminal courts potentially was a reason for instigating further scrutiny of the StubHubs and ViaGogos of this world. And let's not forget, when we say the StubHub and ViaGogos of this world, we're now talking basically about one company,
yeah,
given that technically StubHub and ViaGogo have merged, albeit still subject to approval from the UK competition regulator. But behind the scenes, that merger has gone ahead. But what Fanfare was saying was, we know that these companies rely on industrial level touts for a significant portion of the tickets that are sold on their platforms. And given that we now have a precedent that says at least two of these touts were acting fraudulently, they were breaking the law, that is a reason for additional scrutiny of the StubHub and ViaGogo type businesses. By facilitating the activities of online touts, said Fanfare, there must be concerns that the platforms themselves, StubHub, ViaGogo, are profiting from the sale of tickets unlawfully acquired by their biggest suppliers. This should be investigated as a matter of urgency and lead to action against those platforms if they have benefited from the proceeds of criminality, is what Fanfare says. So, this story is ongoing. We've spent so much time on Setlist talking about all the various twists and turns in this, but it does feel like, I mean, that is a big development, and whereas a lot of our attention, as I said at the outset, has been on trying to force ViaGogo and StubHub into line, it is interesting to see such a resolute conclusion to the other side actually taking on the individual touts.
Yeah, so it remains to be seen what effect this does have on the wider secondary ticketing market. But, I mean, everyone seems to think it's a positive. Well, not everyone. The people who don't like secondary ticketing,
not the people going to jail,
think that it's a positive outcome. The people who are going to jail, I assume, aren't that happy about it. But we'll see if this has an effect on people running similar operations and whether it starts to wane, perhaps, now that there's a definite possibility of a not insignificant prison sentence.
And with regards StubHub and ViaGogo, I mean, as Fanfare have pointed out, because of their campaigning and because of what the Competition Markets Authority have done, if you go to the ViaGogo website in the UK, there's quite a few things about it that are now different than if you go to ViaGogo anywhere else in the world. Which is to say, certain things are now done in the UK which are much more transparent and consumer-friendly. I mean, obviously, campaigners would say still not enough, but nevertheless, it is quite different to what's happening elsewhere. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see if, as a result of this, there are further changes on those sites within the UK. And of course, there are campaigns outside the UK seeking more regulation on secondary ticketing. And I think if people start to see the sites in the UK based on the CMA work, based on the potential impact of this ruling changing the way their sites are run in the UK, then those campaigners are going to increasingly be going to their lawmakers in their countries and saying, well, we should be doing something similar, because while ultimately we would like these people to go away entirely, at least the changes we're seeing in the UK are moving things in the right direction.
Still to come, just how will Brexit mess up the entire UK music industry? But now, the RIAA has published its annual report into US record industry income for the last year, or the year 2019, to be, you know, specific. And do you know what? It's all up.
It's Tall
boom,
up.
Boom, boom. And do you know what's done it? Streaming, that's what.
Yeah.
Streaming now accounts for 80% of US record industry income. And is that making it fall? No, it's not. It's making it boom right out the roof.
So that's your headline stat, because you're right. In terms of trends, there's not a lot in this report that we've not said a million times before, which is streaming is booming, and as a result, the record industry is back in growth.
I did a lot of work to make that exciting, and you straight away undermined it.
But two things to say. First of all, the 80% stat, that is quite interesting, isn't it?
It is.
The other thing to say, of course, every country is in the process of putting out their stats for 2019 recorded music revenues, by which I mean the record industry in each country. So the trade body, the equivalent of the RIAA in most of the other big music markets, all of those reports are coming out at the moment. The IFPI, or IFP, if you prefer.
No.
Neither do I. The IFPI will put their report out towards the end of next month. In fact, I got the invite to the press launch just today.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going.
I'm not.
I know you're not, because you're not interested in these things, but I am. So the big report from the RFPI will come out towards the end of next month, and we'll definitely talk about that on Setlist, because actually what's really interesting is seeing what's happening on a global basis, particularly those emerging markets that have been slowly growing over recent years. But I suppose the reason why we do talk about the US figures, and we are not going to dedicate a section of Setlist to the German figures or the Italian figures or the French figures, it's because we are horribly Anglo-centric and we're only interested in the UK and the US.
The French figures did come out.
And possibly Canada.
The French figures...
Did you read them?
I read a headline.
I saw it in my feed.
They are up. That's all we need to say about that.
But the US is the biggest recorded music market in the world by a long way. And so it is always of interest to us here in the UK what is happening in the US. Also, of course, you know, UK artists do quite well in the US. Lots of UK artists, they aspire to crack the US. So it is always interesting to see what is happening specifically in the US recorded music market. Also, as one of the big traditional music markets, so as we always say, the five biggest recorded music markets in the world by a long way. I mean, I say that. It may be that next month's RFPI figures shows us that South Korea and China now are getting quite close to the top five. We will see. But the big five recorded music markets have always been the US, Japan, and then the big three European markets, which is the UK, France, and Germany. And of those five, the US has seen the shift from physical to digital and then from downloads to streams a lot faster than the other four. I mean, obviously, Japan famously still a CD market, but even the UK, France, Germany, the shift has not been as rapid. So it does feel the US is sort of ahead of where the other big markets are. So these are all reasons why, basically, I'm justifying why we haven't gone with the French figures, and we are looking at the US figures. But also, yeah, that headline stat, that nearly 80%, if we want to be absolutely technically correct, I think it's 79.5%. But nevertheless, very, very close to 80% of recorded music income in 2019 came from streaming. So, I mean, whereas worldwide streaming, I mean, certainly in 2019 would have accounted for more than half of recorded music revenues worldwide. But to account for 80% and then everything else being in the other 20%, I mean, that is telling you that in the US, it is basically all about the streams.
Yes, but there is a caveat here, and it's the usual one, that the US is weird and insists on being different to everywhere else. So there's quite a lot of stuff in the RIAA's streaming category that wouldn't necessarily be included elsewhere.
Yeah, so whereas everywhere streaming does cover both paid-for streaming and free streaming. So here in the UK, when we get the official stats, certainly Spotify Free and Spotify Premium would all be lumped together under streaming. Probably most of YouTube, ad-funded YouTube, would be lumped under streaming. But it is true that in the US, most of the money coming in through their collecting society Sound Exchange, which is from personalized radio services and online radio services and even satellite radio services, that all gets lumped in with streaming as well. Whereas over here, certainly online radio, where it's more like a traditional radio station, it just happens to be delivered through the internet, we wouldn't be counting that in with streaming. We would be putting it under another category called broadcast and public performance. That is where that money would sit on UK figures, German figures, French figures. But that revenue stream doesn't exist in the US because of the quirks of American copyright law. They don't have that category in their pie chart. I think over the years, they've had differing opinions on where the Sound Exchange money should go. I think maybe it was its own thing at one point, but now they're just lumping it in with Spotify and Apple Music and YouTube.
But stop quibbling, because even if you take all of that stuff out, it's still significant, because in 2019, paid for streaming subscriptions were up 25% year on year to $6.8 billion. And that on its own is 61% of the $11.1 billion that the whole recorded music market brought in. So streaming is, I think we're still right in saying, is contributing to this boom.
We are definitely right in saying that. Yeah, so I mean, even if not only did we take out the online radio stations, which wouldn't normally be listed under streaming elsewhere, but even if we were to take out Spotify free and YouTube and all the other free services, yeah, we would still be left with 61% of US recorded music income last year coming in from paid for streaming services, which is really what is behind the growth. We know that in terms of users, the free services often have bigger user bases, but in terms of the money coming into the record industry, it is the paid for services. And that growth, that 25% year-on-year growth of subscriptions, that accounts to, now let me see, what did they say? More than 1 million new subscribers, paying subscribers, being signed up across the different services in America last year. So 1 million new subscribers every month, which means that now more than 60 million American consumers are paying in some way to stream. So that would include the cheapo Amazon services. It would include the family plans. It would include the student discounts. But nevertheless, a significant paying premium user base now in the US, which is really behind most of this increase in the wider recorded music market.
But just out of interest, what is the other 20% made up of?
Yes, so we know that 61% is paid for streaming, which means there's 19% with all the other streaming online radio free nonsense. But what about the 20% we're left with? Or
what tapes doing?
20.5%.
Okay.
Tapes aren't even the 0.5, I'm afraid.
Damn it. I bought a tape recently.
Did you? Yeah. Well, even though you are now participating in the cassette revival, they don't appear. Well, except that we know that of the other 20%, 10% is physical product. So I guess, I mean, that's mainly CD, a bit of vinyl revival, and the 48 cassettes that geeky people sold. I still don't know. I want one year, I'm going to remember to do this research before we come on the podcast and I point out that I haven't done the research and then I forget to do it for the next year. Most cassette sales are happening through services like Bandcamp, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I don't know if these stats include Bandcamp money. So I don't know. Next year will be the year I finally remember to find out whether director fan sales from services like Bandcamp are in here. Because if not, the entire cassette revival is being ignored. Maybe it's not up to 11.1 billion. Maybe it's up to 20 billion. And it's just that the $9 billion cassette revival on Bandcamp isn't being counted. But yes, okay. So yeah, 10% physical. So that's CD, vinyl, and a little bit of cassette.
Or a lot.
Or a lot. Downloads. Do you remember downloads?
Yeah. It's like podcasts.
You'll be pleased to hear that the RIAAA's official pie chart. I got the official pie chart. Did you get the official pie chart?
I've seen it.
I got the official pie chart. Still referring to downloads as digital downloads, which I know is one of your bugbears. But I mean, very soon, digital downloads will be down to 0%, and then we'll never have to hear the term digital downloads again.
God, why, no one talks about digital streaming, do they?
They don't, do they?
That didn't transfer over.
I mean, it's because it alliterates, isn't it? Digital downloads. That's why
streaming,
people
streaming.
Are stuck to it, even though it doesn't make sense. And then 2% people from the synchronization of recorded music into TV. Because in America, TV sync's included in that. In the UK, TV sync would sit under PPL income. But TV sync is included in that 2%, as is movies, games, etc., etc. So that's what
there's always that point here where we say people talk about sync like it's 98% of music income, but actually, yeah, 2%.
It is very small, but as we always say, I mean, that's 2% of 11.1 billion.
It's probably worth having.
And in that little 2%, there will be individual deals worth $1 million, which is why people continue to get excited about sync. Talking about getting excited, Mitch Glazier, the boss of the RIAA, he wrote a little blog post on Medium about these stats.
Yeah.
He got excited.
He did.
Got very excited, not only about the increase in money, but by the magnificent achievements of the record industry in enabling that to happen.
Yeah, he was boasting that the US record industry had seen a fourth consecutive year of double-digit growth and continued to build a digital-driven industry with a focus on the future.
It's all about the future.
Although this report is looking back at the past.
It is. Is the future the cassette revival? Is that is that the future?
Pretty sure.
I'm still waiting for the 8-track revival. That's what I'm holding out for. Anyway, this was an official blog from a trade body.
Oh, right.
So although they were excited and they had their pie chart with their digital downloads and all of that nonsense, it was an official trade body blog post, which means you can't have the joy without a moan. So he managed to get in both a safe harbour moan, although a very subtle safe harbour moan, and a piracy moan.
The two classics.
Safe Harbor, actually back on the agenda in the US. Obviously, we're sick to death of talking about it in Europe. But there are now conversations happening in Washington. Is it time to reform DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, from which the American Safe Harbor comes? So in his blog post, Glazier said that music is by far the biggest draw to tech platforms. Do you think that's true? Definitely true.
Music, yes. Tech platforms.
Says here, by far the biggest draw to tech platforms, gaining views and listens that generate enormous revenues for distributors. I think there he doesn't mean like The Orchard and TuneCore. He means YouTube and those sorts of distributors. But in many cases, this happens without an appropriate share for creators, said he. Meanwhile, on piracy,
he said, our technology partners also need to commit themselves to protecting and promoting artists' work by doing more to stop stream ripping and other forms of piracy. That requires the platforms to work more productively with the music community as partners to stop theft and respect the true value of music. Oh, I haven't heard that phrase for a while. The true value of music.
He'll be talking about bottles of water in a minute, won't he?
It's the true... the true value of music revival.
You always end up talking about bottled water when you start talking about the true value of music for some reason.
And coffee.
So anyway, that was this year's RIAA figures for the American recorded music market. As I say, we will then do the rest of the world. Oh, well, the UK figures may come. We may obviously got some UK figures at the end of the year from BPI and mainly from ERA when it comes to financial income rather than consumption stats. But BPI figures will be incoming, so I'm sure we'll talk about them because we're horribly UK-centric. But we will then talk about the world once IFPI have done the maths.
I feel bad about the French figures now. When are the German figures out?
I can't remember where I've had the German figures.
Next time...
I'm still annoyed about them not having as many strudels as I thought. But maybe we will talk about the German figures and their digital pie. And how many digital downloads are being sold in Germany.
Digital down.
At some point. Anyway, stats.
Stats happened. The end. And finally, this week, despite the UK government's best efforts, we're still here talking about Brexit.
Yeah, I'd heard on the grapevine that Brexit's been done and never need be talked about again.
Yes, I mean, actually, since Prime Minister Alexander Johnson tried to ban the word Brexit, I've developed a new affection for it. I quite like it now.
Yeah, because I've never liked the word Brexit.
Now we're not supposed to use it. I really like it. So Brexit. I'm enjoying it. It's good. And, I mean, even though tea towels tell me that Brexit has been done, it definitely hasn't.
Do all of our listeners know that Boris Johnson's real name is Alexander?
Yes, everyone knows that because you just told them.
Someone was confused when I referred to, it was the Brits story, my Brits write-up. I referenced, because obviously at the Brits. Hey, the Brits happened.
Oh, yeah, that was a thing.
That happened while we were away. At the Brits, Dave in his set called Alexander Johnson / Boris Johnson a racist, didn't he? So in our Brits write-up, I referred to Alexander and someone got very confused by that. It's basically Boris Johnson's real name. It's why we always put Boris in quotes.
Yes, he pretends to be called Boris. It's one of his middle names.
One of his many middle names.
He pretends to be called Boris, so he seems more cartoony rather than the dangerous racist that he is.
So we don't use brand names in the CMU Daily, do we? We say vacuum cleaner, not Hoover.
Is that true?
Therefore, we can't say Boris because it's a brand. But the point is that, yes, Boris Johnson / Alexander, Big Al, Big lying owl.
That's just not calling him Big Owl.
That makes him bad.
That's on a par with Boris.
He's decided that Brexit is done. Brexit is not done.
It is not. Not by a long shot.
We are, of course, in the transition phase, the 11 months of limbo, when basically everything carries on regardless, even though technically the United Kingdom is no longer a member of the European Union. Obviously, the day after we Brexited, quite a lot of pro-Brexit people were like, well, look, the world hasn't fallen apart. Everything's carrying on as normal. And it's like, well, that will probably be because of that agreement that everything will carry on as normal for 11 months. That's what happens when you do a everything will carry on as normal treaty.
Yes.
Everything carries on as normal.
Because we now have our 11-month transition period where the UK government and the EU try to negotiate the future relationship of the UK and the EU. So are we going to get the Canada plus deal? Or are we going to get the Australia-style deal? Those are the two things we're being offered by Alexander Johnson and his team. Obviously, Australia-style deal is a shrewd rebranding of no deal because Australia doesn't have a free trade deal with the EU. So that's a thing. But I believe we're here to talk about music.
We are here to talk at this from a music perspective. Otherwise, we'll be here a very long time. But the point is, this is relevant, that the UK government under Alexander Johnson is now having to start negotiating the future relationship between the UK and the EU, and is also planning for British policy, new UK law after the 1st of January 2021, when we are no longer bound by European law as a result of our agreements with the EU. So what's been happening in recent weeks is, well, first of all, the UK government has been giving us some indication of the attitude they will have, the priorities they will have, the strategy they will have when they begin negotiating this incredibly complicated deal for the UK's future relationship with the EU, which the UK government has randomly decided basically needs to be done by June, even though every single person who knows anything about this will tell you that that's impossible. But that is what has been decided. Meanwhile, of course, in amongst all of that, more Australian stuff, isn't it? They clearly think that the average Brexiteer grew up on Neighbours and Home and Away and Kylie and Jason. Did you see that? I'm going on a bit of a tangent now.
Okay.
But it is kind of music related. On Brexit night, if that's what we're calling the 31st of January 2020, when we technically came out of the European Union and went into the transition period, some people were having parties to celebrate that moment.
I was aware of that.
Where I live in East London, about 4 fireworks went off at 11 o'clock.
Really?
There were obviously 4 people or 1 person with 4 fireworks. I don't know. But there was a photo. I assume it was genuine. I mean, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was mocked up by a pro-Remain person. But there was a photo doing the rounds on social media of a Brexit party at some pub somewhere in the UK, and it was only British food, and it listed some British food, and then only British music, of which one of the artists selected was Kylie Minogue. So maybe Alexander Johnson is onto something, that Brexiteers feel an affinity to Australia. So not only are we going for an Australian-style deal with the European Union, which basically means we won't have a deal with the European Union. When it comes to immigration and how the UK is going to manage immigration post the 1st of January 2021, we keep being told that we're going to have an Australian-style point system.
Yes.
Now that means something. And so the point here is, we are getting to the music industry point, that the government put out its initial thoughts of what the post-Brexit immigration system is going to be like here in the UK.
I mean, if you actually look at the two side by side, what the UK is proposing is quite a lot more restrictive than the already quite restrictive Australian system. It's not that Australia-like. It's like Australia gone slightly weird.
Australia minus minus.
Yes.
I suppose.
Yes.
It would be called. But from a music industry perspective, basically, you can go and read the document if you like. Lots of people have written very informed intellectual responses, giving a music industry spin on it. But basically, we're fucked.
Well, basically, isn't it? Basically, like, you can come to the UK as long as you've got a PhD. Because we need... Because they're talking about skilled workers, and the skilled workers are only people who have PhDs. You have to be very intelligent to be a skilled worker, rather than... I mean, we need people to care for the elderly, which you don't need a qualification for.
But you need a lot of skill. But from a music industry perspective, I suppose there are two elements to this. One is, you know, people from elsewhere in Europe who might want to come and work in the UK, either as a musician who is based here, or they might want to work in the industry, and the challenges, because most people working in the music industry don't have those levels of qualifications, certainly not in music making. They may have a undergraduate degree from a university, but not in a relevant topic. And anyway, you don't need a degree to be a great musician or to work in the music industry. You just need to be good at making music or have a passion for music. Also, there are salary levels, aren't there, that you have to be over in order to come here.
Yes.
And although they've brought it down slightly, because actually...
And there are restrictions if you're self-employed, aren't they?
Well, because so many people in the music industry actually, you know, yes, there's a few millionaire superstars, there's a few very well-paid executives at the majors and at Spotify, etc. But because most people in the music industry and most musicians just about get by, you know, you don't have to set that cap very high before you're basically excluding musicians. But beyond what it means for people who actually want to come and work in the music industry here full time, there is also the big issue, which really shouldn't be a big issue, but about just artists who want to come and tour here and what new bureaucracy and costs we are going to be adding to musicians who want to come and tour here. They just want to play here. They don't want to live here. And of course, there's two issues here. One is for those people who put on shows and concerts and festivals, the idea that suddenly bringing European acts in is going to have a whole load of new costs and bureaucracy attached to it is a problem. But maybe slightly selfishly, even more importantly than that, is our assumption is that whatever the UK does for European musicians, the EU will replicate it for UK musicians, which means that when any UK artists and their crew want to go on tour of Europe as of next year, these new costs and bureaucracy are going to be there for them as well.
Yes, so responding to these proposals on Twitter, the acting chief of UK Music, Tom Keel, wrote, "New plans confirm that from 2021, EU musicians coming to the UK for concerts and festivals will be treated in the same way as those from the rest of the world. This will drag some agents and promoters into the immigration system for the first time and increase the possibility that EU member states will introduce new bureaucratic hoops for UK musicians to jump through when seeking to perform across the European Union."
Now, the government has indicated, well, first of all, I think the government is going to do so many U-turns on all this immigration nonsense that probably isn't even worth us reading what they proposed.
There is so much tough talking at the moment. The compromises are going to come thick and fast, I think.
But they have indicated that there may be some exceptions to these new rules. So, for example, nurses is the category that people talk about a lot, because if we stop people coming in from elsewhere in the world to work in our nursing profession, we're going to be in a massive mess. And so, therefore, every other industry is going to come along and say, well, now you've said that we can have categories of employees that are not covered by these rules. Can we have this category, this category, this category? Now, whether or not that will help musicians or people who want to come and work in the industry full time here, I don't know. But you do have to hope, desperately hope, that when it comes to getting artists over here to perform, and then likewise British artists out to the rest of Europe to perform, that there is some sort of compromise that can be done. And we should stress, you know, the music industry has not given up on this at all. So UK Music, the Musicians Union in particular, are doing a lot of work on this, as are other organisations. MBT, ISM are talking a lot about this. The hope is that some sort of deal can be done specifically for musicians on tour, going in both directions. The challenge is, because the UK government has set itself this insane, impossible deadline, and there are thousands of things that need to be agreed, ultimately...
The music industry is not the only sector complaining like this about the proposed policies.
And obviously, you know, it's reasonable for ministers to say, well, even if we think you're right, realistically, you're not going to be that high up on the list of priorities. And how far down the list of priorities do the government get in negotiating all of this? So, I mean, as with everything to do with Brexit from the day the referendum went through, although we are getting new papers coming out from government, we're getting new policy statements, we're getting some guidance on what might happen with immigration post-2021, we are actually still in the same position we have been since 2016, which is we don't really know what's going to happen. Somebody asked me the other day, what impact will this have on streaming income and download income? And you know, will there be any new taxes or whatever? And it's like, well, we just don't know. Because until these deals are actually done, it's really hard. Just as we're preparing to record this, another statement came out of UK Music. This is in relation to documents that have come out from both the UK and the EU regarding strategy, ambitions, objectives for the upcoming talks on this very complicated deal that needs to be negotiated. And again, some concerns there.
Yes, its statement said, UK Music fully supports the need to secure a comprehensive free trade agreement between the UK and EU. Market access is vital. We need to avoid a cliff edge at the beginning of next year, which could spell disaster for music. It is welcome that both the UK government and European Union are prioritising the need to secure high standards of protection for intellectual property rights as part of the new relationship. A strong copyright regime is crucial for our £5.2 billion music industry. They always like to get the figure in. That figure has helped a lot over recent years, as we've discussed on previous editions. Since they started talking about the number of billions of pounds that music contributes to the economy, politicians have started talking a lot more favourably about the music industry.
Of course, talk of copyright there, relevant because the UK government has no plans to implement the European Copyright Directive. The UK music industry wants elements of that copyright directive implemented here, but also that there should be ongoing conversations between the UK and the EU on copyright matters. But of course, in the short term, copyright is not the priority. Getting artists touring is a priority. So they also said some stuff about that.
Yeah, they said the UK's attempts to seek clarity on allowable activities for short-term business visits should include live touring across the EU. We need certainty as to how artists, musicians and crews can go about international concerts and festivals across the EU from 2021 without administrative and financial burdens.
So we shall see how the government responds to that. I mean, there are supporters certainly within Parliament for this, and indeed within Alexander Johnson's government. I mean, Nigel Adams, who has been a big supporter of the music industry in recent years, who was in culture department, he's actually now moved off to another department, so not directly involved in music matters. But I mean, he's one of the people actually in government who has said, yeah, this is going to be a problem for British artists. We need to do something about it. So there is support, and that's why UK Music MU are doing everything they can to rally that support. But as with everything, there are so many things to be sorted out between the UK and the EU for post the 1st of January 2021, and all these insane deadlines have been set. I mean, unless ultimately they do backtrack on this commitment that if it's not all sorted by June, then we'll just go out without a deal, then even with supporters in Parliament, even with supporters in Whitehall and in government, there is so much insecurity still as to exactly what will happen. It could still be that in a year's time, from a music industry perspective, not a lot changes, but that totally depends on the agreements that are done between now and then. And at the moment, we've no idea how that might turn out.
Well, hooray, there's a gloomy note to end on.
There's a nice gloomy note to end on. But hey, streaming boom, American music industry up. Woo!
That is all we've got time for this week on Setlist. Do download those special editions that we mentioned at the beginning. If you haven't already, they're very interesting. You should definitely listen to them. And subscribe so you get future episodes automatically delivered to your podcast app of choice. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU, presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook this week. Produced and edited by Andy Malt too. Hooray for me.
Look at you getting double credits.
Well, more than double credits. I could have done produced by Andy Malt, edited by Andy Malt. Theme tune, me, I did that.
Yeah, you did, open up GarageBand and do some tapping.
That is all that counts.
Which we might call
that
composition.
Counts as composition.
So, produced, presented, edited, composed by Andy Malt production.
And Chris Cook was there too.
I was here. I can confirm that.
Witnessed by Chris Cook. for more on CMU, why not go to completemusicupdate.com?
Setlist is an unlimited production.